Okay, so this is Bio 241, and it's Monday, September 15th, and we're going to start Chapter 6 today, and the test you'll get back in lab. Now, I don't know if anybody is in here from Friday's lab, but the instructor didn't know that the tests were ready. They were sitting in her mailbox. So next time, just remind the instructor that as soon as you take the test, they're going to be ready to review. So the Friday group, just let your instructors know that the tests are in their mailbox for you to. Monday. That's because I didn't get them back from the Friday instructor in time to give them back to you guys today. But anyway, your grades are in Blackboard, and so the next group that we'll see will be Wednesday's group. Okay, and if you need to see it before then, come see me during office hours. I'll be happy to show you. Okay. All right. So. That's kind of the format of the tests, right? Multiple choice, then matching with figures. It's going to be kind of that format from here on out, okay? Okay, and you have materials online to study in Blackboard. All right, so the extracellular environment, that's everything outside cells, right? Extracellular. 67% of the total body is made up of water inside cells. That's the intracellular compartment. On the extracellular side, that's outside the cells, that makes up about the remainder, about 33%. Of that 33%, I think we actually saw this in maybe the first chapter or something, 20% of what's ever outside the cells is the extracellular, in the extracellular compartment is what we call blood plasma. That's outside the cells. That's the matrix that makes up blood. And 80% of the extracellular fluid is what we call interstitial fluid. And this interstitial fluid is contained in a gel-like matrix between cells. And that is a nice conduit for diffusion of gases and molecules to all different cells in your body. Okay, interstitial fluid, 80%. Plasma is about 40% of that extracellular fluid compartment. All right, so the extracellular matrix is a meshwork. So here we see the extracellular matrix right here of collagen fibers and elastic fibers. And they're linked to the gel-like ground substance in the matrix, as well as to the plasma membrane of cells. And I don't see that on this particular slide right here, but remember the fluid mosaic model of a plasma membrane? There's all kinds of things that are embedded in the membrane, and one of those things are glycoproteins. And so what's a glycoprotein? What comes to mind? What's a glycoprotein? It's part protein and part sugar, right? It's a protein made by rough endoplasmic reticulum that's been modified in the Golgi apparatus and then inserted into the membrane. And that interacts with collagen and the elastic fibers in the extracellular space to help anchor the cells in position. All right, and so don't forget that interstitial fluid resides in a hydrated state of gel, which we call ground substance. All right, so let's talk about transport across membranes. Maybe you guys even had a lab this week on this phenomena. I'm not quite sure where that happens in the class, but probably this week. Okay, next week? All right, well, last week. Oh, you guys are ahead in lab. All right, so the plasma membrane, don't forget, is what's surrounding the cell, and that separates the living processes from the non-living processes outside the cell. And that membrane is selectively permeable. Or we sometimes say, what could we say? Instead of selectively permeable, you could say semi-permeable. But what the heck does that mean? What does semi-permeable mean? That's right. It only allows certain kinds of things to move through the membrane. And probably generally speaking, you should be aware now of what kind of things can freely pass through a membrane without any special structures in the membrane. What kinds of things can move through a membrane? Okay, and the typical answer for this is, or are, nonpolar compounds. Because what do we find inside the membrane, the inner layer of the membrane? The inner layer of the membrane. Well, I tell you what, let's start a little bit more simply. What's the basic structure? What's the basic internal structure of a cell membrane? It's a phospholipid bilayer, right? And so what's the internal layer made up of? Lipids. Yeah, it's a big hydrophobic region and it's continuous, so only hydrophobic molecules can pass through the membrane. Hydrophilic molecules won't be able to go through, and that includes ions. They can't get through that lipid layer. So there has to be ways that the cell can deal with that barrier. Okay. So there are many important molecules have transporters or maybe channels through the membrane. There are some membrane proteins that facilitate carrier-mediated transport. This involves a specific protein transporter. And then there are non-mediated transport mechanisms that just occur by diffusion. And sometimes these require protein molecules in the membrane as well. So there are two main ways, if we're going to group transport processes across a membrane, there's passive and active. And passive just means that it does not require energy. So what's the form of energy that's used in your body? ATP, yeah, the molecular form is ATP. So passive transport does not require ATP. It happens automatically just by the physical rules of the universe. And what determines where something will move by passive transport is according to the gradient. There has to be a gradient of concentration. And so how can things move without energy and a gradient? Okay? Things can move from high concentration to low concentration. They will always just move to lower concentration. So if I have a perfume bottle here in the room and it's closed and I open it up and there's no perfume anywhere in the room, right, because it's all inside the bottle, I open up the bottle, it diffuses or evaporates into the air around the bottle. Even when there's no fan in the room, what's going to happen to that perfume? It's going to move. It's going to be transported in the room by what process? That's what we call diffusion, because it's high concentration by the bottle and it's really low everywhere else in the room, basically zero. So who's going to smell the perfume first?
Me.
Yeah, well, me, then you. Okay, then you, and then it's going to move up to the back recesses of the room, right, because that's where the lowest concentration is. And if we leave the perfume bottle open all night long and come back the next day, guess what's going to be the concentration gradient in the room? You know what? It's going to be homogeneous. It's going to be the same in the front, the same in the back. And if it's the same, is there any net movement of molecules?
No.
No, the movement goes to zero as soon as the concentration gradient goes away. So the concentration gradient is the driving principle. When the gradient goes away, then everything stops. So anybody have a hard time remembering which way things move by diffusion? Not too difficult, but I tell you what, I'll give you a really quick demonstration right here. I used to drive, I think, a 1968 MGB. It was a little sports car. It was about as big as this table right here. It was pretty good. But it was not a 1968. It was much later than that, so it was a really old car when I had it. So it had problems. It wouldn't like to start. And I went to school in Illinois, and sometimes it gets below zero in the wintertime, so you couldn't work on your car when it's so cold outside. So sometimes the battery was dead, sometimes the starter motor was out, all kinds of different problems. So I learned that if after school, when I couldn't start the engine with the key, I would do something, right, so that I could go home. I would always, when I got to school, where would I park? On top of a hill. Because when I would get out of work or school, right, what could I do? If I couldn't start the car with the battery, it was a little car, I'd just stick my big toe out the door and it would start rolling down the hill, and what could I do? Pop the clutch, I would start the engine, and then I could go home. It was always a good thing. All right, so going down the hill is what? Without the engine on, is that active or passive? That's passive. It doesn't require energy. No gasoline, right? Because there's potential energy stored by being on top of the hill. So this is a passive process, right? So passive is always from what? High to low, down over here. That happens automatically. But active processes are possible. All right, it's possible to get this car up the hill. How do you get the car up the hill? You got to spend some energy, right? Like gasoline, for instance. So going up the hill is active, and in this particular case for us, going from low to high, that would require, what, ATP to do that. All right, so that's kind of a nice example. You should never miss on a test or a quiz for diffusion or a passive process which way things go. For passive, it's always what? High to low. So always just think of that example right there. And active processes are allowed, right, because at the beginning of our perfume experiment, we had high concentration of perfume, right? But to get all that perfume in the bottle, what had to happen? Somebody had to spend a lot of energy to get that perfume and concentrate it and put it in the bottle. So it's allowed, but you have to pay for it in terms of energy. Okay, just like putting that car up on top of the hill. So active transport moves compounds against the concentration gradient, which means what? Low to high, at the expense of ATP, and it might even require some kind of special mechanism or transporters to do that. And guess what? When you build a transporter, do they automatically just appear? No, you have to build them, and that usually requires energy as well, more energy. Right, so active processes require energy in all kinds of different ways. All right, so when we think about transport mechanisms, always group it into one of these two categories, either active or passive, and think in terms of a concentration gradient, which way that goes. So here we have a slide on diffusion, and it's just a random motion of molecules. The net movement is from a region of high concentration to low. So if we have a beaker right here, and should we define what a solution is? Maybe we've done that already. What is a solution? Yeah, it's the, I'm going to say it a little bit different, solvent plus solute right here. And the solvent in us, the only thing we're really interested in is water. And solutes are things like what? Yeah, amino acids, sodium ions, glucose, right? All of the solid stuff that's dissolved in the solvent, those are solutes. So these particles right here, the dark dots, do they represent solvent or solute? I suppose it could be either way, but let's just say it's solute. Those are the, let's just call that sodium or glucose or something like that. And the slide is labeled. Can you see where this is a higher concentration on the left compared to lower concentration on the right? Yep. Yeah, because there's just a whole lot fewer dots on the right-hand side. So there are going to be movements of these particles in the lower concentration over to the left, but there's going to be far more going from left to right, and so we say the net diffusion is going from left to right. All right, so the net diffusion is always going to be from high concentration to low. And the speed of this reaction is going to depend on a number of things. The surface area, this area between these two partitions right here, the size of the molecule, is this ringing a bell from lab at all? The molecular weight of the compound, right? And the temperature, because what is temperature? What is temperature really a measure of? Molecular motion of something. So as the temperature increases of a molecule, what happens to the state of a molecule? Yeah, it gets more and more excited as the temperature goes up. And, you know, we could take a picture of a molecule, like, for instance, what's this molecule right here? That's water, right? And so that would be a pretty good picture of this molecule right here. But a better picture, what would be a better way to represent this molecule right here? Not just to take a picture of it and write it on the board, but to do what? Actually pull out your video camera and video it. Because what is this molecule doing? It's moving. It's vibrating and twisting and bending around. And that vibrating and twisting increases with temperature. And that's really what mixes all these molecules up, because these molecules aren't just sitting there, right? They're vibrating, and as the temperature goes up, okay, they vibrate faster. So the rate of diffusion increases with temperature. And then, when the concentration is the same, there is no net diffusion. Diffusion stops. So you should say that the concentration gradient is the driving force. All right, so is that what you guys covered in lab? You can see diffusion. Yeah, diffusion is temperature-related, surface area-related, and molecular weight, the size of the molecule. So again, using a little automotive analogy, if you have a semi-tractor trailer with a big semi and a motorcycle at a stoplight, and the light turns green, who's going to accelerate faster? The little motorcycle, right? Sure. So the smaller the molecule, the faster it will diffuse. Okay. I don't have that on my slide, but you cover that in lab. All right. So nonpolar compounds readily diffuse through the cell membrane. And why is that? Because the cell membrane is? Well, the cell membrane has that big hydrophobic region on the inside. And so those are the only kinds of molecules that can move through the cell membrane, lipid-soluble compounds or hydrophobic molecules. But also some small molecules like CO2 and water sometimes can diffuse through a membrane. And somebody in class mentioned that. But there are a lot of cells where water diffuses through the membrane because there are special water channels. Water by itself has difficulty moving through the cell membrane because of that hydrophobic region. And as a matter of fact, that's how oxygen and CO2 gets to all the cells of our body, just by that passive process that we call diffusion. So what's a chemical compound that a cell needs in order to make energy? Mitochondria need glucose, and they need oxygen in order to make ATP. And there's a relatively high oxygen concentration in the room, and there's relatively low oxygen concentration in the cells. So oxygen will just diffuse from where? From the air into the cells, because that's the concentration gradient. If there was high oxygen concentration in the cells, it would actually diffuse out of our body. All right, and that wouldn't be helpful. That's not how it works. So oxygen diffuses in because the concentration is the lowest by these cells. All right, and through the processes of metabolism, then glucose is broken down into CO2, and mitochondria make ATP in the process. So inside these cells, there is a high CO2 concentration, but that is a waste product in our body that we have to eliminate. And it just so happens that CO2 concentration in the air around us is basically zero. It's maybe about 0.03%. It's very, very low. So when your cell produces a carbon dioxide molecule, it diffuses out of your body because the atmosphere is just a wonderful place for it to go because the concentration is so low. So again, would you consider that diffusion? Yes or no? And why? Yes, you say yes. I like yes. And it's diffusion because things are going from high to low, and it doesn't require any energy. It just automatically happens. So some of these basic principles of how things move around inside your body just happen that way automatically in a very nice way. All right, so here we see that plasma membrane with a phospholipid bilayer. So this is a large hydrophobic region. So water molecules and any kind of charge molecule or polar molecule can't get through this region right here. But nonetheless, there are many kinds of charge molecules that should transit the membrane. And the way that cells accomplish this is by putting special proteins inside the cell membrane that can form a channel, or you could actually think of a pore, that will allow these molecules to move through the membrane even though it has this big hydrophobic region right here. So charged molecules like ions, give me an example of a good ion. Sodium, potassium, chlorine, magnesium, calcium, for instance, need channels to go across the cell membrane. And we're going to see in a little bit that your cell can control what ions move through the plasma membrane and under what conditions, because sometimes these proteins are open. They have a patent channel. And other times, these proteins can change configuration and they can be closed. preventing the transference or the movement of these ions across the membrane. Okay, so cell membranes are impermeable to charged and most polar compounds. All right, but lipid compounds can move across the cell membrane. And the cell can even choose at a particular time what ions to allow to move across, so the cell membrane is what we call selectively permeable, and it even can change over time. All right, so the rate of diffusion of a compound depends on, you'll have to modify this list right here, the magnitude of the concentration gradient. That's obvious, because when the concentration gradient is zero, what happens to diffusion? It stops, right? So the higher the concentration gradient, the faster things move. The permeability of the membrane to it, that I don't think you dealt with in lab, but if the membrane is highly permeable, that will increase the rate. If it's barely permeable, that will impede the rate. Temperature, what happens to the rate of diffusion with temperature? It speeds up, because what happens to the molecules? They start moving faster and faster. Things get mixed up faster. All right, and the surface area, as the surface area increases, what happens to the rate of diffusion? It increases. Okay, so in lab, I like to introduce this way of thinking about diffusion. Okay, so the rate of diffusion, and I'm going to put an equal sign here. You know what that means? An equation. Okay, equation. All right, so what is the rate of diffusion? All right, what can speed up the rate of diffusion? Temperature. All right, that's one thing. What else? The gradient. Yeah, gradient times what else? Surface area. All right, I'm just abbreviating. Surface area, permeability. Yeah, we could put that in there. Running out of board. All right, so I'm just going to put P right there, permeability. Okay, now what slows the rate of diffusion down as it increases? Molecular weight. And what's molecular weight really equal to? That's really equal to the size of the molecule. Okay, but I'm going to put molecular weight. Now, should that go up here or down here? Down below. Okay. So I'm going to put molecular weight down here. All right. So there are ways that we talk about this basic kind of equation. Okay. So the rate of diffusion is related to temperature, but how is it related to temperature? If the temperature goes up, what happens to the rate of diffusion? It goes up. That's what we call directly related. So if we have some variable here, it's going to be related directly to things in the numerator and inversely related to things in the denominator. So it's not direct and indirect. It's inverse, because that's the mathematical operation right there. It's inversely related. So a lot of times, maybe even on a test, I'll ask you, how is molecular weight related to the rate of diffusion? You would just say, in one word, inversely related. Right? You can memorize that, but you should get an idea of what directly and inversely related to. I'll use that a lot in the class. Okay? Okay, that's a little algebra right there. So what does inversely related mean? Okay, if something's inversely related and it increases, what happens to the variable? It decreases. It goes the other way. Okay? So just kind of get a little working in your mind of that. Okay. All right. Osmosis. Osmosis is a special condition of diffusion. Oh, I erased solute. All right. So what's a solution again? Yeah, solution is equal to solvent plus solute, okay? And osmosis has to do with this equation right here. So the first thing is that osmosis is diffusion. So there are three criteria for making something osmosis or not. The first criteria is that it's got to be diffusion. But we learned what diffusion is. It's a number of different things. What does diffusion mean to you now? Something's going from high to low? And what else? Diffusion is only from high to low? And? Passive. It's passive. Those are the two things that come to my mind. No energy is required. So that's what diffusion means. So maybe in parentheses we can say what? High to low, or down a concentration gradient, comma, passive. No energy is required. That's the first thing for osmosis. The second thing for osmosis is that the molecule that's diffusing in a solution has got to be one particular species. And it's one of these two right here in the equation. It's the solvent. It can only be the solvent molecule. And in you, what's the solvent molecule? What's your favorite one?
Water.
Yeah, pretty boring group, but that's true. Okay. Water. So in us, it's water. Okay. So this second part right here, it's only the water molecule that's diffusing. That helps make osmosis, but that still doesn't really determine whether it is or not. There's got to be one last thing. And the third thing is that there has to be a semi-permeable membrane someplace. So water has to diffuse across a semi-permeable membrane. And then it's osmosis. So osmosis is just kind of a special kind of diffusion, right? But it's still absolutely passive. All right, so osmosis, here's the definition, is the net diffusion of water across a selectively permeable membrane. That satisfies all our three conditions right here. Water diffuses down its concentration gradient. Water is less concentrated where there are more solutes. Yeah, do I see it on this slide over here? All right, so these dark particles right here, the dark particles represent the solute. So when we look at this, which side, left or right, is more concentrated in solute? The right side is more concentrated. And typically, that's how we speak about concentration. Right? The right side is more concentrated. But it's more concentrated in solute. But let's think about it now in terms of the solvent molecule. All right, so we're going to turn the tables a little bit, look at those two compartments. Which one has a higher concentration of solvent, the left or the right? The left, because there's less solute in the left compartment over here. All right, so you got to be careful when you read a question, maybe on the web or something, which particle that they're talking about. Is it the solvent molecule or the solute molecule? All right, in everyday language, we always think of the solute, but that might not be what the question is asking for. And this is a good particular case. So in this particular case, which way is water going to move? By osmosis, which means what? Passive, high to low? Is water going to move from left to right or right to left? From high concentration, which is on the left, to low concentration on the right. But it's what? It's the solvent molecule, not the solute. Okay. So if we look at this enlarged area right here, we see a lot more water molecules on the left-hand side of this membrane compared to the right-hand side. There's something else. How else do I know that this is osmosis of water and not just the diffusion of water down a concentration gradient? We see a membrane right here, but it's what kind of membrane? It's special. It's semi-permeable because of the size of the pores don't allow the solute molecule to move across. Water can move across because it's small enough to fit through those pores. But the solute is too big, so therefore it cannot equalize itself and move down its concentration gradient. All right, so in that particular case, we say that these solutes, because they cannot move across the membrane, are osmotically active. Osmotically active means that they're stuck on one side of the membrane, can't move across, can't equalize their concentration. So what is the only molecule that can equalize its concentration?
Water,
because it's small enough to move through these pores. All right, so if we set this experiment up and we have water able to move, we said it's going to move from which way? From left to right. So we're going to have a net movement of water over in this direction. What's going to happen to the size of this little cube or the size of this chamber as water goes over there through the membrane? It's going to expand. It's going to get bigger. Okay, because water is being drawn into that compartment. Okay. So that's something that osmosis does. So water will diffuse down its concentration gradient. Right? Water moves over here until it's what? Equal on both sides that we see over here. But now let's look at this membrane. It's been what? It's been deformed. It's been pushed out over in this direction. And I guess we could be a little quantitative over here. We've got volume X. So in volume X, it's the same volume, right? The glucose concentration is 180 grams per liter on the left-hand side at the beginning. And it's what? Twice that on the right-hand side. All right, then we start the experiment. Water is going to move across, and it's going to equalize to where we have 270 grams per liter glucose on both sides. But now this volume over here has got to be bigger. It's got to be 4/3, okay, times what it was initially, which means this has got to be smaller on this side. Right, and cells can do this. Cells can regulate their size and shape depending on the water concentration or allow water to diffuse it. And again, a lot of membranes don't like to allow water to diffuse, but some cells have these channels to facilitate osmosis, and these are called aquaporins. Now, there might be a time when you produce more urine than others. One might be a time that you produce more urine after you're drinking a lot, for instance, right? Okay. Well, this is one way that your body can regulate how much water your body loses by inserting these aquaporins into membranes of your kidneys, the cells of your kidneys. And more water can move through the kidneys. But when you're in a dehydrated state, guess what your body does? It removes these aquaporins from the cell membrane, and that traps water inside your body. So you don't produce a dilute urine, but a very concentrated urine. So we're gonna view aquaporins when we get to the urinary system. But aqua is pretty easy to remember, and pores, these are what? Water pores for osmosis of water. All right, so there's a concept called osmotic pressure. All right, osmotic pressure is a force that would have to be applied to stop osmosis. All right, and this picture right here just says, what? If we have pure water over here, water's, and we have 180 grams per liter glucose on the right-hand side, water is going to definitely move over to the right-hand side, and it's going to force this membrane, what? Over to the left, right? But we can prevent that from happening by what? Physically pushing the membrane back. And we can actually measure that force or that pressure to keep the membrane in the same location. And that's what we call osmotic pressure. And that's just proportional to the solute concentration over on the right-hand side of the equation over here. Right, that's osmotic pressure. So that can be measured. So that's a nice physical pressure that actually develops. Okay, well, since I'm using some of these terms, grams per liter, let's talk about a couple definitions, chemical definitions right at the moment. Molarity versus osmolality. Right, but again, it has to do with the amount of solvent and the amount of solute that's in a solution. A one molar solution, symbolized by the capital M right here, is one mole of a solute dissolved in 1 liter of solution. And it doesn't specify the exact amount of H2O. So if we have, for instance, a bottle right here, That's 1 liter. Okay. We have to put in, here exactly 1 mole of solute. Okay, that just means a certain standard number of particles of whatever that substance is. Different substances will have different weights depending on what the mole amount is, but a mole is just a certain number of particles that doesn't change from one kind of compound to another. All right, so we put 1 mole, we could say 10 particles into here, and then we take water, H2O, and put it in here so that it fills where? Exactly to this 1 liter mark right here. This would be a molar solution, as opposed to a molarity. How do we get molarity? Let's start with our same bottle or flask, like this. We put in the same number of particles, 1 mole of solute, all right? But we also put in 1 liter, all right? And 1 liter is going to be exactly the same as 1 kilogram of H2O. So that's how they define really what a liter is, or a kilogram. They're exactly equal to each other. 1 liter is exactly equal to 1 kilogram. Okay, it's got to be pure water. It's got to be at a particular temperature. All right, so I tell you what, if we don't put this solute in, and we put 1 liter or 1 kilogram of H2O in the beaker, where is it going to go to? Exactly that line. That's just with pure water. But now let's put some additional stuff in there. Let's put 1 mole of solute in this bottle. What's going to happen to the level on the bottle now? It's going to be a little bit higher. All right, so it's going to rise a little bit, maybe up to over here. All right, so when you mix up a molal solution, you get more than 1 liter. When you mix up a molar solution, it's exactly 1 liter. All right, so that's molar, this is molal. So molar goes exactly to the 1 liter mark. The molal is a little bit greater because we don't take into account the volume of the solute that we've put in solution. All right. A last term that we're going to look at is what we call osmolality. Right? And osmolality is the total molality of a solution, the total molality of solutes in solution. Right? So here we have a 1 molal of NaCl yields a 2 osmolar solution. Why is that? Because when we take one mole of, what's it asking for, NaCl, and put that in water, so it's just a certain number of particles of NaCl that we put in water, but when we put sodium chloride in water, what happens to it? It's going to break apart into sodium plus chloride. So now how many particles are in solution? Is it still 1 mole? It is actually now 2 different particles, so this is 2 moles of particles that we put in solution. And so that's the osmolality of the solution. So you have to consider the dissociation of particles. And that's going to determine the osmotic pressure. So for instance, we're going to compare, okay, a 1 molal solution of glucose and 1 molal solution of sodium chloride. Initially, but they're the same osmolality, but the sodium chloride is going to break apart into 2 particles right over here. All right, so after dissociates into 2 particles, then the solute concentration is twice that compared to the glucose, and it's going to exert twice the osmotic pressure. All right, so this is going to force water to the right, and that's going to increase the size of this chamber over here. All right, because a 0.75 molal solution of sodium chloride is exactly the same as what? A 1.5 molal solution of glucose. And why is that? And that's because glucose does not break apart into two compounds. It always just stays one molecule. It doesn't break apart. Doesn't dissociate into two. All right, so that's going to force water to move into the sodium chloride solution. Now, okay, this does rely on something else. What can you tell me about this membrane in order for this to work just in this particular way? It's impermeable to both glucose and sodium chloride. Because if glucose and sodium chloride could diffuse back and forth, then there would be no osmotic pressure developed and the membrane wouldn't change shape. All right, so on this slide, I'm going to cover just these first three topics right here. Okay, this has to do with tonicity. Tonicity is just a measure of pressure. It's the effect of a solution on the osmotic movement of water. All right, so isotonic solutions have the same osmotic pressure on either side of the membrane. That means that they have the same number of particles in solution on either side of the membrane. A hypertonic solution has higher osmotic pressure and are what we call osmotically active because these particles can't move across the membrane. It's a selectively permeable membrane. Hypotonics have lower osmotic pressure. So what the heck does that mean? Okay, this is what I want you to know. Let's do a couple experiments right here. Let's take this beaker and let's put a solution in this beaker and what's this right here? That's a red blood cell. Okay, that's an RBC. And all cells in your body have this amount of solute inside the cell, and we're just going to say salt, but it's all solutes all combined. All right, and it's going to be 0.9% NaCl. Of course, there's other solutes in there besides sodium and chloride, but we'll just use that as a ballpark representation. And the rest is water. So how much is water inside the cell? 99.1% water inside the cell right here. Okay, and sodium and chloride, of course, are going to dissociate. They're going to try to get through this membrane, but they can't. They're going to bounce off. So what kind of membrane is that? That semi-permeable membrane. Water, on the other hand, can go through the membrane. And how is it going to go through the membrane? Okay, you don't know yet, but generally speaking, if it's going to go in a net direction through the membrane, it's always going to go high to low. Okay, high to low. So that means it's going to move passively through a semi-permeable membrane, so that's osmosis, right? All right, so now I got to tell you what solution this is right here. Let's say this is, let's just say this is distilled water, which is 100% H2O. Okay, no solutes right here. So which way is water going to go? Okay, because 100 is bigger than 99.1. Numerically, it doesn't look like that's much of a difference, right? But that is a difference nonetheless. Well, so much water is going to go inside this cell. The cell is going to swell initially, but that will produce such an osmotic pressure that that cell is actually going to what? It's going to lyse. If you want to say burst, that's fine, but no, lysis is the same thing as bursting. All right, that membrane is not strong enough to exert an osmotic pressure to counter, all right, this amount of water entering the cell right here. So it's going to burst.
So this this water right here, we could consider it a solution without any solutes in it. This is what we call a hypotonic solution. Hypotonic. And since this is a red blood cell, when we lyse it, we call this hemolysis. Hemo for blood, lysis for breaking it up. So a hypotonic solution is going to what? Hemolyze cells that are placed in it. All the cells in our body are going to explode if they're put in extracellular fluid that is hypotonic. They will explode. What happens to the cell then? It's dead, right? I mean, it just blows up like a balloon. Don't have a balloon anymore. All right, so this kind of solution is what? That's going to kill cells if you put cells in that kind of solution. All right, let's go to a third case. So here's the third case. Yeah, but this is the second one. Here is our cell. What's the concentration of salt in a cell, typical cell? 0.9%. Water is 99.1%. All right, that's a typical cell. Now, in this particular case, let's mix up some seawater, make it a little bit more concentrated. Let's make the seawater 95% H2O. How much is salt? 5% salt. Same cell, can salt move through the membrane? Nope, can't move through. So again, this is a nice example of osmosis. Right, semi-permeable membrane, water is going to move. And of course, water is going to move from where? High to low. What's higher, 99.1 or 95? 99.1 is higher. So, that's okay. I thought I didn't hear complete agreement right there. So here you got 99.1, water is going to leave the cell. What's going to happen to the shape of this cell right here? It's going to shrink. That's one way of saying it. The proper term would be crenate. Right, crenation is what's going to happen, and the solution that produces crenation is a hypertonic. Hypertonic solution causes crenation. So maybe you guys did this in lab. If not, you probably will one of these days. Now, if we want to transfuse somebody, and we don't want to hemolyze their body or their blood, and we don't want to crenate their blood, right, because we want to keep these cells healthy, what do we have to give them? A fluid that matches the osmolality, right, of what's ever inside the cell. So what's inside the cell, once again? 0.9% NaCl, 99.1% water. So, in this fluid right here, we need 99.1% what? H2O and 0.9% salt. All right, so will water osmose? What's higher, 99.1 or 99.1? It's the same. So, the net diffusion is going to be zero, or probably a better way of saying it, the net osmosis is going to be zero because there is what? No concentration gradient. So when somebody's transfused or given drugs, IV, this is the kind of solution that has to be used. Otherwise, you're going to blow somebody's cells up, you're going to lyse them, or they'll be crenated. Either case, it's not a very healthy situation. Okay? So medically, this is extremely important. And even in sort of day-to-day understanding, it's interesting as well. Because, okay, I got case one, case two, case number three right here. Let's look at a couple drowning victims. Is it easy to tell in what kind of water somebody drowns? Drowning is what? When your lungs are filled with fluid and you can't get air inside there? Forensically speaking, is it easy to determine what kind of fluid somebody drowns in? For instance, ocean versus a swimming pool. Okay, so if somebody drowns in an ocean, which case, one, two, or three, explains what their cells will look like?
Okay, in the ocean, that's hypertonic, their cells are going to be all crenated. You'll be able to see them underneath a microscope, but they're all going to look, what, jagged and spiky and things like that. Okay, if somebody drowns in a swimming pool or bathtub or something like that, what is their blood going to look like? All these cells are going to hemolyze, will just kind of look like red Kool-Aid. You won't see any cells in there at all. Okay, no strange visual? Okay. Oh, I'm sorry if you like red Kool-Aid. Okay. All right, so this is real important for a number of different reasons, but also that sort of tells you why you have to maintain fluid balance in your body and what happens if you don't. There was, I think last year, there was, or year before, there was a contest on the radio, and somebody was giving away a car, and I forget where it was. If it was, it wasn't in California, I don't think. Or maybe in California, I'm not sure. And the person that could drink the most water would win a nice vehicle. All right, so can you overdose on water? You know, as a matter of fact, you can, and maybe that's not very common knowledge. But what happens to you if you drink too much water? If you drink more than what you can excrete through your kidneys in a normal period of time, okay, all that water gets absorbed by your blood, all right, and then once it gets into your plasma, where does it go? It goes into red blood cells, all right, and they start to hemolyze, but not just red blood cells, but all that water goes. This is actually pretty gruesome. If you didn't like the red Kool-Aid, whoa, you won't like this even worse. But where all this fluid goes into all the other cells of your body. So what happens to all the cells of your body? They start to swell up, right? So you get bigger and bigger and bigger. But there's one part of your body that can't get any bigger. The cells are swelling up, but that place can't get any bigger. Where's this place that can't get any bigger? Your brain, right? It's stuck in the cranial vault. So all those cells start to swell. But there is one place your brain can go. It can go out the foramen magnum. Okay? So that's really a dangerous circumstance, and that's how people die when they overdose on water. Their brain swells, and it just kind of gets squished out of all the foramina, right, and of the cranial vault, in particular the foramen magnum. And that's what happened to this person who was trying to win this car. And I think it was a woman that died as a result of it. And they told her, oh, you know what, you really need to go to the emergency room. And she just really didn't believe them. Okay, but they maybe could have saved her life if she got there early enough. I don't know who ended up with the car. They probably got the car and the radio station, is my guess. Okay, so you can overdose on water. There is a recreational drug that's been associated with water overdose because it stimulates your hypothalamus to think that you're dying of thirst. And there are a few cases of people overdosing on water thinking that they're actually being dehydrated and have this insatiable thirst. And that's methylene diamine, methamphetamine. What's that? Anybody? That's actually, yeah, ecstasy. Okay, that's one of the side effects of ecstasy. So if you're out at Burning Man next year in a desert and it's 110 degrees and you're thirsty, it's thirsty because you're dehydrated, but don't overdo water if you're taking ecstasy. Okay. Yeah, thanks for the tip. Okay, so here you have a little diagram in your book. Here you have a normal cell. It can expand when it's put in a hypotonic solution. It will crenate when it's in a hypertonic solution. So what kind of solution? No, what does a hypotonic solution produce? What does it produce? These are typical kinds of exam questions. And I'll tell you how I could remember this. Even though I don't give a lecture in maybe 20 years on this topic, I can figure it out. Okay, a hypotonic is going to cause hemolysis because, well, you know the physics of it now, but the way that I remember it, there's an O in hypotonic, there's an O in hemolysis. So when I'm lecturing and trying to talk and think at the same time, it's easy. All right, and crenation is easy to remember without thinking because there's an E in crenation, there's an E in hypertonic, right? But you should understand the mechanism that's involved here as well. Okay, so regulation. So you think regulating body fluid is important?
Absolutely. So let's look at some physiology that is involved with regulating blood osmolality. And that's just the total number of particles that are in solution in your body. All right, so not in terms of percent, but in terms of molality. All right, so blood osmolality is maintained in a narrow range, basically about 300 milliosmolar, that's 0.9% solute concentration. If dehydration occurs, there are sensors that measure that decrease in osmolality, and that stimulates the hypothalamus. So we have a normal response loop right here. So how does a response loop always start? With a stimulus. And how does your body know it's being stimulated? It's got to have a sensor or a receptor. And in this particular case, right, the stimulus is dehydration. And what measures that? Osmoreceptors, right? Osmoreceptors measure osmolality in the blood, and then they stimulate the hypothalamus. All right, so hypothalamus is the integration center where there is a set point. So when you become dehydrated, there's decreased blood volume, right? Because you're losing that fluid volume, you're sweating, and that increases the saltiness of your blood. That's measured by these receptors, and the information is sent to the hypothalamus. Then the hypothalamus is going to compare that value to the set point, and the hypothalamus then has to make a decision. Well, when it's dehydrated, the decision that's made is that it's going to give you the sensation of thirst, right? So what's that going to do? You're going to drink to replace some of the fluid you lost, but the hypothalamus will also increase the secretion of antidiuretic hormone from the posterior pituitary. And it's connected to the hypothalamus. It's actually the same neuron that goes from the hypothalamus, but it's released in the posterior pituitary, ADH, or antidiuretic hormone. Well, what does a diuretic do? Makes you pee. So what does an antidiuretic do? Makes you retain water. All right? So here are two mechanisms that are working together. You're increasing your water by drinking, and ADH prevents you from passing it, right? So, and these are by working by the kidneys and then by drinking. So what happens to your water balance, right? That increases, right? So how? So this is the response, increasing your water content. So how does that relate to the initial stimulus? Does it add to it or subtract from it? It subtracts from the initial stimulus. All right, so what kind of feedback loop is that? That's a nice negative feedback loop that brings you back to the blank that's in the integration center. It brings you back to what? The set point as a result of that. So here's a nice mechanism. What kind of mechanism is this? This is a homeostatic mechanism. It's a mechanism that maintains homeostasis or water balance in your body. Okay. All right, so antidiuretic hormone, don't forget, makes you retain water. Okay, membrane transport mechanisms. We have carrier-mediated transport. When molecules are too large or maybe too polar to just diffuse through a membrane, they're transported across the membrane by what we call protein carriers. Remember, what's the best way to think of the phospholipid bilayer that has just phospholipids in it, but we can also incorporate proteins? What's a good way to think of the phospholipid bilayer when it's got all these different kinds of proteins and glycoproteins? What do we call that model that really is a better description? The fluid mosaic model of a membrane, right? So some of those mosaic pieces are specifically there to act as carriers across the membrane. All right, so these protein carriers exhibit these three different characteristics. And there is specificity, there is competition, and there is saturation. So let me see if I can describe what these different things are. Okay. So a good picture, I don't think I have a picture. Oh, yeah. All right, so here is the phospholipid bilayer, and then here is the protein that's going to allow for
movement of these solute molecules across the membrane. Okay, so what does specificity mean? That means that those protein molecules will only allow the transport of one particular molecule. And that is going to be determined by, primarily, all right, I want to write this on the board. Specificity is going to be determined by the shape of the molecule. That's really the most important thing. Maybe minor, in a minor way, maybe some electrical charges on it, some other physical characteristics, but primarily the shape. So if there is a transporter that can transport a molecule that looks like that, when another molecule comes around that looks like that, what's the rate of transport for that molecule? I would say zero, because it doesn't look like this one at all. Because the shape of the molecule that's being transported has to be complementary to the shape of the transporter. And if it doesn't match, then it won't combine with the transporter and it can't move across the membrane. So that's what we mean by specificity. Now if we have another molecule that maybe looks like, that looks like, well, that's looking pretty good, but looks like this. All right. Now, this one looks pretty similar to that one, has kind of the same general shape, but it's definitely different. The transporter might be able to transport this one as well, even though it has a different shape, but it's still close to the first one. Okay, so now both A and B molecules combine to the transporter, and when that happens, A, B, when B binds to the transporter, okay, guess what happens to the availability of that transporter to A? It goes away. Okay, so that's what competition is. So for dissimilar molecules, it exhibits a high degree of specificity, but if there are similar kinds of molecules, there might be competition. All right, and some molecules that might be similar, for instance, would be glucose, which is a monosaccharide, with another monosaccharide. What did we learn as another monosaccharide in here? Galactose? Fructose? Might be similar. It's a little farther away. But there might be a transporter that can transport glucose, but it will also have some affinity for a different kind of sugar monosaccharide, like galactose, for instance. Okay, so if there is galactose, that will inhibit the transport of glucose because it takes away binding sites on that particular transporter. Okay, and also the third thing is that carrier-mediated transporters in the membrane exhibit saturation. So there are a finite number of these proteins in the membrane, and when they all get bound to, say, even species A over here, right, so when A binds to a transporter, right, can another A bind to the transporter? No, it can't. And when all of the transporters are bound with A, even if we put more A in, it won't increase the rate at all because all the transporters are occupied. They're busy transporting molecules. So that's what we say what saturation is. So we can show this graphically. Let's make a plot of rate of transport of some compound X versus the concentration. All right, so the rate will increase as we move up the vertical axis, and the concentration of X is increasing as we move to the right. So that's what we're going to plot right here. Okay, so the solid line represents a solution with just molecule X in it. And as the concentration of X increases, what's happening to the rate of transport? It's increasing, and more the transporters are being occupied by molecule X, and they're transporting them across the membrane. Okay, and then at a particular point right here, this is what we call the transport maximum. Even if we increase the concentration of X, we don't increase the rate of transport anymore, because what's happening at this point? It's saturated, which means what? All the transporters are occupied with that solute X, and they can't work any faster than they're working. So if you wanted to increase the rate of transport here, you'd have to build more transporters and put them in the membrane to get more X across. And we're going to see that our body does that. We can change the point of saturation for transporters. All right, so we see saturation here. Now, the dotted line represents what? Specificity, competition, or saturation? Okay. It actually shows, yeah, that there is competition. Now we have two similar molecules. They're similar enough in shape to bind to the same transporter. So if we have Y in solution as well, they're going to block the available transporters to X, and so the rate of X, right, will increase, but the new transport maximum is lower because this amount of transporters now is being occupied by molecule Y. So the maximum transport is decreased because of this other molecule that can bind to the transporter. But if what would happen if molecule Y had this shape right here? Then it wouldn't compete, right? The level of saturation, or you'd reach saturation at the same point, right, would be the solid line up over there. Okay, so that transport maximum is what we call T sub M. So here is an example of facilitated diffusion. So diffusion, again, is what kind of process, if you were going to pick? Is it active or passive? It's passive. What does that mean? Things go from high, down a concentration gradient, high concentration to low. All right. But facilitated diffusion just means that this is a way for molecules to move, for instance, inside the cell, but these molecules can't get through the plasma membrane because of this hydrophobic region right here. All right. So there's a carrier protein. So it will allow the movement of solute, which is high outside the cell, to inside the cell, which is lower, but it gives them just a way to do that via this transporter that's in the membrane. A good example of that would be a glucose molecule that's high outside the cell. Glucose is a good molecule to have inside because it's an energy molecule. You can make ATP from it via mitochondria. But it's a polar molecule, so it can't get through the cell membrane by itself. So it has these little transporters in the membrane. Glucose can bind to the transporter. You see the shape of the glucose is similar to the binding site of the transporter that's in the membrane. So since it has the same shape, we would say that this transporter is specific to that particular molecule. It won't transport a sodium or a potassium or a protein because it doesn't have the right shape. But when glucose binds to this site on the transporter, it causes a change in conformation of the transporter, and it kind of looks like a little teeter-totter right here. And now the protein is open to the inside of the cell, and of course glucose can dissociate and find its way inside the cytosol of that cell, moving down its concentration gradient. But the energetics of this won't work the reverse way. Glucose cannot leave the cell due to this transporter. It just won't ever work. Because in order for it to go in the reverse direction, what would this protein have to do to change conformation? It would need energy. What's the form of the energy? It would need ATP. I wish I could draw on that slide. But in order for this protein to work in the reverse direction, ATP would have to be available in the cell, bind to this protein, and then be hydrolyzed into ADP and inorganic phosphate, which then would cause this change in conformation to go back to here, right, if glucose was going to go back the other way. But that does not happen. Okay, so these transporters are commonly used in cells of our body to take glucose up, but does glucose enter cells all the time? Do cells have the ability to take up glucose all the time by themselves? As a matter of fact, there's a disease, right, where people can't regulate blood glucose. It remains high because glucose can't get inside the cells over here. What disease process is that? That's diabetes mellitus, right? There are a couple different forms of diabetes mellitus, but one of the reasons is that these transporters, right, normally are found inside the cell. Remember, this plasma membrane of the cell membrane can form a vesicle inside the cell. So here we have a vesicle inside the cell, and in this vesicle, it contains what? Many, many of these glucose transporters. And when the transporters are inside the cell, what's the ability of the cell to take up glucose from the outside? It's basically nil. It doesn't have the ability to do that. All right, but when blood glucose levels increase, there's a hormone that's in normal people that's released called insulin. And insulin is the signal for taking this vesicle and inserting it into the plasma membrane right here. And now where do you find those transporters for glucose? In the cell membrane. And therefore, the cell can take up glucose, thereby decreasing the plasma concentration of glucose. And when insulin levels decrease, guess what happens to these transporters? They're bound back up and placed in a vesicle inside the cytoplasm. And when they're in the cytoplasm, then that's going to maintain the blood glucose level. So it's always going to be a balance of putting these transporters in the membrane and taking them out, putting them in, taking them out, and that's a function of insulin. So that's one thing that we're going to look at when we start talking about glucose uptake. Okay. This right here, I should have mentioned this when we were talking about cell organelles. We talked about a number of different vesicles. We talked about secretory vesicles. What were a couple other kinds of vesicles? Did we have any on the test? Probably. What was another kind of vesicle inside the cell? And what was its function? How about lysosome? What's the function? Digestion. What's another vesicle? Peroxisome. What's its function? Detoxification. Here's another kind of vesicle. And in your notes, write the name of this vesicle down. This is what we call an endosome. So a job of an endosome is to act as a storage form for transporters that are in the membrane that can be put into the membrane or taken out of the membrane. Yeah, an endosome is a reservoir for membrane transporters. And those membrane transporters with the proper signal can be put into the membrane or they can be sequestered out of the membrane and thereby regulating transport of a molecule. One important molecule we see here is what? Glucose. That's one way that your body regulates cellular uptake of glucose by putting these membrane transporters in the membrane or reincorporating them back into an endosome inside the cell. All right. So this facilitated diffusion, is this active or passive? Active or passive? Active or passive? Okay. Okay, so don't forget. Passive goes from high to low. Here we have high glucose outside, low. That's the way glucose is moving. It's moving from high to low. So that is passive. That's a passive process. There's another easy way that you can tell this is a passive process because on an illustration, if it were an active process, you should see another molecule involved here. What's that other molecule that's needed for active transport? ATP, right? And I don't see ATP on this diagram anywhere, okay? But I bet on the next diagram I do. Active transport. All right, so here we have the nice plasma membrane again, and here's a transporter. It's a protein inside the membrane. Active transport means what? That something can move from low to high against its concentration gradient. And here we have a calcium that's low inside the cell, and it's high on the outside. And if your cell wants to kick this calcium out, it's got to have ATP in order to do that. Well, calcium is going to diffuse around inside the cell, right? Just move around inside the cell. It's going to bump into this protein here. And once it's inside this protein, then there's a site right here that can bind an ATP. And This is an ATPase. It will hydrolyze ATP into ADP, an inorganic phosphate. And don't forget, there's a third substance right here. What's that third entity? If we have ATP, it can be hydrolyzed to ADP plus inorganic phosphate plus, what's the reason why we need ATP? Energy. And excess energy. It's got excess energy to be donated to some kind of process. And this particular process, right, that energy, extra energy is going to be picked up by this protein, but it's going to cause it to change conformation. So again, it's going to teeter-totter, and it's going to open up to the extracellular side of the cell so that calcium then can move to the outside of the cell. But this conformation change, right, from the top slide to the bottom slide requires that energy that's in ATP to drive that conformation change of the molecule. All right. The other thing is that this protein right here is never open to both the outside and the inside of the cell at the same time. Okay? It's only open to one side or the other. And that's ATP is required. There are other kinds of membrane transporters. Here is one that doesn't move just one compound, like for instance calcium in this example. Right, we see that it is actually moving two compounds. One is sodium and the other is potassium. And actually, you know what? I want to go back one slide. Okay. A protein that's in a membrane that can use energy, namely ATP, to make a molecule move from low concentration to high generally has a name. And I want to tell you what that name is. So what do you say if you have a well at home with water down in the ground and it's going to go from low to high, right? It's going to require energy to get that water out of the ground, right? It goes from low to high, requires energy. What do you call that device that gets water out of the ground, making it go from low to high? That's a pump, right? So that's what we call a pump. So we use that kind of thinking to name this protein right here. We call this a... not a water pump, but a calcium pump, because it's pumping calcium from low to high. Okay. So a protein in a membrane that can move something from low concentration to high concentration using ATP, that's a pump. Right? And you don't have to use your arm. You have to use what? ATP. Okay. Here is another pump. It's going to pump both sodium and potassium, right? Sodium is Na, potassium is K. So which way are sodium and potassium going to move? They're going to move up their concentration gradient, which means what? Low to high. Both are going to go in that direction. All right, so here is that protein. And inside the cell, this is just something that you got to be really familiar with in this class if you're not already. The concentration of potassium is different from the inside of the cell to the outside, and the same for sodium. It's different across the membrane. And this is basically what you got to remember. Inside the cell is high in potassium, as long as the cell is alive, and it is low, that just means it's low outside the cell. So potassium high inside, low outside. Sodium is the opposite. Sodium ions are high outside, but they are low inside. So I got a couple mind teaser questions for you before we break, and that is, for potassium, okay, going from outside to inside, is that active or passive transport for potassium, going from outside to inside? Active or passive? Okay, don't forget, passive is what?
High.
High to low. So going from low to high is active. So going from low outside to high inside is active transport. What about sodium? It is low on the inside. It's high on the outside. See, I even have to stop and think. Okay. It's low on the inside, high on the outside, so if it goes from inside to outside, that is active as well. All right? And so that's how you could tell this is active transport. But what's another clue that this is active transport? You got ATP that's being hydrolyzed into ADP plus PI plus what?
Energy.
And that energy is used to drive these two ions up their concentration gradient, okay, from low concentration to high. But notice that they go in different directions. All right, so you got to know where potassium is high in a cell. You got to know where sodium is high. And you got to know what's the general name of this protein in a membrane that can use ATP to move something from low concentration to high concentration. That's a pump. That's right. Is there one last thing? Maybe one last thing? Okay. The kind of pump. We also can have to classify pumps. If these two different molecules are moving in the same direction, that's one kind of pump. But in this case, which way are these two molecules moving? In opposite directions. This is what we call an antiporter. Antiporter, if they go in opposite directions, if they move in the same direction, they're called a symporter. So a sodium-potassium pump is an antiporter. And what does the sodium-potassium pump need in order for it to operate? ATP. That's right. And what happens if your cell runs out of ATP? Then the sodium and potassium equalize on either side of the membrane, and then that cell is dead. Okay? Okay. No sign-in sheet for today.